From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with veteran political reporter and syndicated columnist David Broder. His new book, Behind the Front Page, critiques how the news is reported. Also today, film director Stephen Frears talks about bringing the life and death of gay British playwright Joe Orton to the screen. Frears' film Prick Up Your Ears follows up his critically acclaimed movie My Beautiful Laundrette. Rock historian Ed Ward takes a look at the underrated lyrics of one of the first great rock and rollers, and book critic John Leonard reviews the latest work by South African novelist Nadine Gordimer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me today is Washington Post political reporter and syndicated columnist David Broder. In his new book, Behind the Front Page, Broder turns from the pursuit of the news to an examination of the pursuers. He calls what we read in the morning paper a partial, hasty, incomplete, flawed, and inaccurate rendering of some of the things we have heard about in the past 24 hours. His book examines those flaws. Each year, Broder's double duty at the Post has him traveling about 100,000 miles. He's worked at the Post for 21 years, and his columns are carried in 300 papers across the country. Before joining the Post, he worked for the New York Times, the Congressional Quarterly, and the Washington Star. He began his newspaper career at the Bloomington Pantograph in Bloomington, Illinois in 1953, 2 years after graduating from the University of Chicago. In 1973, David Broder won the Pulitzer Prize for distinguished commentary. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Terry, I'm glad to be here.
One of the issues that you raise in your new book, Behind the Front Page, has really become a big issue in this past week with the Gary Hart story. And I'm thinking of the question, how relevant is a political candidate's character and how does a reporter cover the character? What's your opinion on the Miami Herald's stakeout story on Hart's relationship with the woman who was at his apartment?
I thought the paper made the right decision in following up on that tip. The reporting was flawed, as almost always our reporting is flawed in the first instance, but I thought their judgment was correct to go after that story.
What are the ethics of a stakeout?
Well, none of us are very comfortable doing stakeout duty. I've done it many times, not on a meeting of a political figure with a woman acquaintance, but often with candidates or politicians meeting with other politicians. I've stood with my ear up against the door trying to overhear conversations in closed rooms. And we do it essentially because we think something is taking place which is relevant and important for the voters and constituents to know.
Well, something like what the Miami Herald did, what's the difference between doing a stakeout in front of someone's apartment and being one of those celebrity photographers who hang around waiting for somebody to come out so you could snap their picture?
The difference is this, and it's what we have to try to make clear and to be sure that we set the right example in our that this becomes a precedent for the right kind of reporting and not for the wrong kind of reporting. When you're dealing with a presidential candidate, incidents that may be of no great significance in themselves become important if they help to reveal important character traits. If I can take just 1 second, 4 years ago, a colleague of mine at the Washington Post, George Lardner, was doing a standard profile of Gary Hart. I've told this story in the book. And in the course of his reporting out in Kansas, George came across what seemed to be an odd and minor discrepancy. Gary Hart had given his birth date in a number of profiles as being 1937. In the family records, in some of the early things written about Gary Hart out in his hometown, George found the date as being 1936. So what he did is what a good reporter does, goes to the person he's writing about and said, "Senator, what about this? There seems to be some confusion about what your birth date was." Hart stonewalled him, simply would not clear it up for him. Time and time again said, "I'm not going to discuss that." Finally, on the day before the profile was going to run in our paper, Lardner tried one more time with Gary Hart, and Hart's response was, "The date is whatever the records say it was." Now, that incident had no made no difference to anybody whether Hart was born in 1936 or 1937. But his unwillingness to deal with a relatively clear question and to his creation of a mystery about this aspect of his personal life obviously sent off vibrations, first with the reporter who wrote it into the profile, and then with people who read about it and said, what is going on here? That's exactly what happened in this recent sexual adventure. Nobody in the press corps cares to know about what Gary Hart was doing that weekend, except that he had made a great issue of asserting that he was or was not doing certain things, and when confronted by those Miami Herald reporters with evidence that suggested to the contrary, he simply would not deal with the reality of it.
So you think the big issue is that he lied, more so the fact
truth,
than maybe he had an adulterous relationship.
I think truth-telling is an important issue for the American people because they have seen too many presidents mislead them. I think the ability to maintain your keep your obligations to other people, starting with his wife, starting with the people who had made sacrifices to work in his campaign, and his willingness to recognize reality and to deal with realities. Those are important things for the people to understand about somebody who wants to be their president.
When you say deal in realities, do you mean in a way, if he was really smart, he would not even be inviting a woman over to his apartment, knowing the kind of press coverage that he was getting?
I think most of us in our jobs, and few of us ever have jobs with remotely the pressure that operates on a president or presidential candidate, but most of us in our jobs understand that there are certain advantages that go with a job and also certain inhibitions that we take on as part of doing that job. Gary Hart's job right now has been running for president. If he doesn't understand that that involves certain inhibitions on what would normally be his private activities of no concern to anybody else, then he really didn't deal with reality very well.
Do you think he was guilty of bad judgment?
Terrible judgment.
Back in the days of John F. Kennedy, now we know that, or we've been told that he had a lot of relationships with women other than his wife, and it's my understanding that reporters who knew about that protected him from the public. It was understood that that was his private life and it shouldn't be covered. Do you think that we're better off with the change in atmosphere that we have now where a candidate or a political official's private life has become as public as it has?
Personally, I'd be much more comfortable if we could simply draw a sharp line and say after 5 o'clock or outside of the office is no concern of ours. But we are products of our times and our history and our culture as much as anybody else. And the fact that we have had a succession of presidents whose actions in office have shocked, dismayed, and disillusioned the people who put them in office makes us feel that we have to go further than we have in the past to bring to the American people information that is relevant to the character, to the competence, to the record, to the ideas of these presidential candidates. Otherwise, we bear a share of the guilt when those presidents are revealed to be something other than what they pretended to be.
In one of your columns, you wrote that you just had this intuition that there was something not quite right with Hart. And I'd like to know what it was that was giving you that feeling and how you'd handle it. You're writing about it now, but how would you handle it if there wasn't something to peg it on?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I mean, first of all, let me say, Gary Hart is a man for whom I have had great admiration. I respect the fact that he has gone through a series of political challenges and has very much been his own man in all those things. He is an inner-directed person, and that's a rare thing to find in politics. He is serious and competent in handling issues. That's a wonderful quality. But if you began to look closely at Gary Hart, the thing that struck me first and most forcibly was when I started going talk to some of his Senate colleagues and 4 or 5 years ago when he was beginning his first presidential race and said, you've worked closely with him over the years. You have seen him in a way that I can't possibly see him. Tell me what he's like. And what was striking was that among those men with whom he had spent his working life, few of them felt that they knew him, few of them felt that they had established any kind of stable personal relationship with him. And that sends off a few old alarm bells. What do you do with it as a reporter? What I did in 1984 and again earlier this year was to say, isn't it striking that Gary Hart, who has all of this support in the public, who seems to be the leading candidate, that so few of the people who have worked with him seem to want to endorse him, to support him, to stand up and vouch for him? Isn't that a striking thing? It should have, and I hope I wrote that intending that it raise questions in people's minds about what sort of a person he was.
David Broder is my guest. Let's get back to the Miami Herald coverage for a moment. Do you think that we're going to see a lot of ambush journalism now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't believe that the Washington Post or the Philadelphia Inquirer or CBS and NBC are now going to divide up their political reporting teams and say, you've got the duty between 4 and 8 p.m. to watch the back door of the following candidates. That's not what's going to happen. That would be foolish. That would be mindless to do that. What I think it will mean is that we're going to look more closely from now on than we have in the past at those aspects of these prospective presidents which are relevant for the voters to understand and which they don't seem to be ready to clear up themselves. Sometimes it's a policy question. We really don't know, for example, what most of these men would do to deal with the federal deficit, with the trade deficit, which threaten the economic future of this country. Sometimes we ought to find out and look closely at their records. I mean, George Bush has been Vice President of the United States for the last 7 years. We have an obligation to probe as far as we possibly can as to what parts of the Reagan administration's record reflect the influence and the input of George Bush and what do not.
You said before that you covered a couple of stakeouts yourself, and that you had to listen in, put your ear to a door and hear what was happening.
Keyhole journalism, as it is now called.
What stories did you do that for?
I'll give you one example. After the 1964 campaign was over, there was a great effort in the Republican Party to try to dump Dean Burch, who had been Barry Goldwater's choice for Republican national chairman. I learned that Dean Burch was going up to New York to meet with Richard Nixon and some other people there. I followed him, got on the plane, followed him, went to the hotel where the meeting was supposed to take place, tried to listen to what was going on in that meeting, and stood there in the corridor waiting for the people to come out so that I could try to ask them what had been going on in that meeting. That was not an assignment which I felt terribly comfortable.
Did you feel like
about
a snoop while you were doing this?
I felt very much like a snoop, but I also felt this is a major political party about to make a major political decision there, and my responsibility is not to be comfortable, not to avoid embarrassing myself with people that I knew fairly well. My responsibility was to try to find out what was going on in that meeting, because there were lots of other people who had a stake in the future of the Republican Party who would be interested to know what was going on in that discussion in that room that night.
You're really writing in very exciting times now as far as the news go. I mean, just in the past few days, there's the Gary Hart story, there's the Iran-Contra hearings. Is it invigorating to be writing about such big stories, or are you more concerned with what's happening to the presidency, for instance, with the Iran-Contra story?
When there's a major story that has the public's interest, you'd be lying if you said you weren't sort of charged by the opportunity to cover a story that a lot of people are interested in following. But if you're asking me what would be my druthers, I wish that this hadn't happened to Senator Hart. I didn't know whether he was going to be the nominee or not, but I thought he would play a major and useful role in testing the abilities of the other candidates and possibly winning that nomination himself. I surely rather that we were dealing with some of the other questions in our foreign policy than trying to find out how as dumb a decision as selling arms to Iran came to be made.
Okay. This is Fresh Air, and I'm speaking with Washington Post political reporter and syndicated columnist David Broder. His new book is titled Behind the Front Page. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Washington Post political reporter and syndicated columnist David Broder is my guest. He's written a new book titled Behind the Front Page. I'd like to talk about your life a little bit. And you've seen a lot of news happen. You've written about a lot of news in your time. You call yourself a news junkie. I'd like to know how this addiction first started.
At my parents' dinner table, I was an only child, so I listened to adult conversation from the time I was able to sit up straight enough to be brought to the dinner table. And this was in the years of the Depression and leading up to World War II. They were very concerned. Neither of them was involved in politics, but they were had a great interest in what was going on. And that's what I heard talked about. And I think another part of it, to be honest with you, is that if you're skinny or ill-coordinated or have bad eyesight and you're a kid, you can't play sports very well. I was all three. So the next best thing to do in junior high and in high school is to write about sports. So that's how I sort of got onto school newspapers.
Oh, the sports beat. Well, you know, journalism wasn't as glamorous as it's considered to be today.
No, indeed. In fact, when I started out my first job on the Pantograph, I knew that this was going to be fun because I'd worked on school papers and I knew it was fun. But I assumed that at some point I'd have to grow up and find a real job. Well, I was turned out to be lucky enough, so I didn't have to ever find a real job.
You've been covering presidential candidates and presidents, the White House, for a long time. Who was the first president that you covered?
Dwight Eisenhower was the president when I came to work in Washington. I didn't really cover the White House. So I was working for Congressional Quarterly then. But I went to watch his news conferences, which were fascinating.
Were you in awe of the man and the office during the beginning stages of your career covering the White House?
Absolutely.
How did that affect your ability to cover the president well?
That's a hard question. I was writing more about Congress at that time than I was about the president, but I marveled at watching reporters stand up to the president of the United States and ask the direct, sometimes challenging kind of questions. I mean, this was the man who had led the American armies that liberated Europe. He had been the first commander of the NATO forces. He was a great man, and I knew that. And yet here were people in my business doing exactly what they were supposed to do, which was not to be disrespectful, but to ask the hard, probing questions that needed to be asked so that the American people could understand really what was in the mind of the President of the United States. And that was a terrific model. And when people talk now about how the presidential news conference is just become a piece of theater, it's really not worthwhile at all as a way of getting news, I wish I could show them films which were taken of those Eisenhower news conferences. They were not theatrical events. They were exchanges between reporters who were looking for the story and a president who, goodness knows, the American people had enormous respect and affection for, but who understood and said when he was asked that the obligation to answer these tough questions from reporters was something that went with the territory.
Do you remember the first really tough question you asked a president?
Yes, I think I can tell you what that was. It was an issue that's forgotten now. It was something called the Dixon-Yates contract. It involved a contract that had been given for some work on a dam related to the TVA. And there were suspicions that somehow there'd been some hanky-panky. And it was a planted question. A member of Congress called me up and said, if you have a chance, Why don't you ask the president this? Because we're getting very funny signals from the Interior Department, and we're not sure whether they're really talking for the president or whether they've got some agenda of their own that they're pursuing. So with my knees quaking, I stood up and asked President Eisenhower a question about the Dixon Yates thing. And it turned out that, in fact, the position that had been asserted by the Department of Interior was not a position that he had authorized and not one that he felt comfortable with. That's exactly what a press conference ought to do. It ought to give the president a chance to speak for himself to the questions that are in the political domain.
Did that make it easier for you to ask tough questions?
I think so. I mean, part of it was just you got to do it once. I mean, it's like falling. You got to fall off the horse once to know it's not going to kill you.
One of the issues you address in your new book, Behind the Front Page, is what you describe as click journalism, which is the tight relationship that a lot of political reporters have with the politicians that they cover. Now, has that changed a lot since the time you started reporting?
I think there have always been a handful of people at the very top in Washington journalism who've had a special kind of access and relationship to presidents and to top officials. We know, for example, that Walter Lippmann, the greatest American journalist of this century, was an advisor, was an editor for president's speeches, was doing all sorts of things that, in his own view, his own stated principles, a journalist should not have been doing. What's changed, though, is this. As the salaries of Washington reporters have increased, as the status of those reporters, as the visibility has increased, more and more of us have come to think of ourselves as being part of the Washington establishment. And I must say the politicians are very good at flattering our egos by showering us with invitations and compliments and so on. We're in real trouble as journalists if we think of ourselves as part of that establishment. We are properly the permanent resident critics of that establishment. And if we don't keep that in mind, then we can't do our jobs for the people who are outside that charmed circle of insiders.
Your editor, Ben Bradley, was very close to John F. Kennedy and has, you know, written a book about him. Does he give any guidance to the reporters about the distance he thinks reporters should maintain from the politicians they cover?
Bradley's view, vehemently expressed in language which I won't repeat exactly here, is keep your distance from these people. I think what happened in his case is something that was quite innocent at the beginning. They were neighbors in Georgetown. They were both very much young men on the make. Kennedy is the political world, Bradley in the journalistic world. He was the bureau chief of Newsweek. Kennedy was a senator about to run for president. They liked each other. When Kennedy became president, it became a matter of pretty self-conscious mutual manipulation. It gave Kennedy special access to a major source of information to the American people. It gave Bradley special access to the Kennedy White House. And they rationalized it by the fact that they had been close friends before any of this had happened to either of them. So, but it's a bad precedent. And if you had Ben Bradley sitting in the chair that I'm in, he would tell you it's a bad precedent and a dangerous precedent, and you don't want to get yourself involved in that kind of a situation.
There's a kind of flip side to the click journalism, and that is the heat you might take from the White House if you write a bad story about the president. Does that happen to you? Does your phone ring if you write a critical column?
Your phone rings, and also calls that you place often go unanswered. But this is a trade-off that reporters have to be willing to make. I mean, if you're an honest reporter, you know that inevitably some people who've been important sources, useful sources, or maybe good friends are going to be unhappy about what you've written. You have to resolve those conflicts in favor of your obligation to your customer, to the reader, to the listener, to the viewer. Otherwise, if you start making that trade-off, that is truly the slippery slope.
You've seen during your career the rise of the television journalist and the preeminence of the television anchor and the television White House reporter. They're the real, you know, star reporters now, I think. Has that tipped the balance at all? Do you get less attention because you're print and not television?
I think it's clearly tipped the balance, but that's fine because there are enough people who want a somewhat richer diet in terms of their the content of the what they learn about government, politics, public affairs than they can get from commercial television to keep coming back to newspapers. And that's fine. I think as long as we're serving that audience, we're doing all right.
But I'm thinking of the White House, for instance. Are they going to save their goodies for the network correspondents instead of, you know, leaking the news to or giving the good stories to people in the printed press?
White House is going to do what it wants to do, and we can't try to out-strategize them. We got to do our own job, which is reporting the president on our own terms rather than their terms. And that's where we've too often, I think, fallen down.
One of the criticisms you make of President Reagan is that when he gives interviews, what you get are prepared anecdotes and excerpts of speeches, and it's impossible to penetrate past that. Does that mean that you don't much care about getting an interview with him anymore?
That's not so much a criticism of the president as it is a description. I mean, I think that he simply has very limited interest in trying to sort of step back, analyze, and reflect on his own policy choices. So it's not really real productive. I would not obviously turn down an opportunity to interview the president. That's an opportunity which you can't miss as a journalist. But it doesn't drive me crazy that those opportunities are not offered.
Is political reporting as satisfying as it used to be?
I think it's more satisfying because in many respects we've gotten much better tools for doing our job. For example, an important part of the dynamic of any campaign is what's going on in the voters' minds. And with what we've learned about interviewing techniques, about the use of focus groups, the combination of the old-fashioned door-knocking, precinct-walking interviewing with scientific polling, I think we have better tools to monitor what's that dynamic. And that's a part of the kind of reporting. It has no glamour to it at all. It means walking into yards with barking dogs and introducing yourself to strangers who don't really believe that a reporter from the Washington Post is interested in their opinion, and then sitting down with them and listening to what they have to say, because the American people always have things to teach you if you just listen to them.
We only have about a minute left, but I'm wondering, you put in, what, 100,000 miles a year traveling around the country and the world for your political coverage and your columns. A lot of reporters drop out of reporting because in some places the pay is not that good, and also some people consider it a young person's game because it takes so much energy to keep it up. You've kept it up for a long time. Do you consider reporting to be a young person's game?
Certainly it helps to have energy. So far my energy and interest in it hasn't flagged, and my incompetence as a manager is obvious enough, so the Washington Post has never threatened me with managerial duties. So I've been lucky. But it is really lucky, because there are papers where when you reach a certain level of salary or seniority, they say you've got to go manage other people. You can't just do your own job.
David Broder, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
My guest has been Washington Post political reporter and syndicated columnist David Broder. His new book is titled Behind the Front Page, A Candid Look at How the News is Made. On the next edition of Fresh Air, I'll speak with Eugene McCarthy. He's a former Democratic senator from Minnesota. Since leaving public life, he's been a poet and essayist. This is Fresh Air. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funds come from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Yeah.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, film director Stephen Frears discusses his latest movie, Prick Up Your Ears. The movie follows the life of gay British playwright Joe Orton, who was murdered by his lover. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward says it's time one of rock's legends was as well known for his lyrics as he is for his beat. Critic John Leonard reviews Nadine Gordimer's latest novel, Sport of Nature. It's about a young woman's sexual and political awakening in South Africa. And we'll have the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Time for the news. This is Fresh Air. Now let's hear from our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward. Rock lyrics often take a backseat to the beat, but Ed wants us to listen to the words behind one of rock and roll's legendary rhythms.
I walk 47 miles of barbed wire. I use a cobra snake for a necktie. I've got a brand new house by the roadside, made from rattlesnake hide. It's got a brand new chimney up on top, made out of human skulls. Come on, take a little walk with me, Arlene, and tell me, who do you love? Who do you love?
I walk 47 miles of barbed wire. I use a cobra snake for a necktie. I got a brand new house on the roadside, made from rattlesnake hide. I got a brand new chimney made on top, made out of a human skull. Now come on, take a little walk with me, Arlene, and tell me, who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love?
What in the world is that bit of verse? It's the work of an American folk poet whose words are often overlooked in light of his more famous achievement, Bo Diddley. Bo Diddley was born Elias McDaniel on the next-to-last day of 1928 and moved to Chicago with his stepmother when he was five. The almost wholesale migration of black Southerners to Chicago's South Side kept the youngster in touch with the rich verbal traditions of his Mississippi birthplace, and he probably heard the same jump rope chants, ring dances, and play party songs that folklorist Alan Lomax was collecting in the South at about that same time. Chicago probably had a local equivalent of a strange instrument that Southern kids used to accompany these verses, a wire attached to a broomstick on one end and a door or wall on the other. You'd draw it tight, adjust the tension with the broom, and twang it like a mouthbow or jew's harp, using a distinctive rhythm. It was called a lot of things, but one thing it was called was a Bo Diddley. Elias McDaniel learned the guitar in Chicago, but in order to support his wife and kids, he became a boxer. Hanging around the gym, he probably took part in another famous black verbal tradition, the dozens, a game in which insults are traded, the filthier and more personal the better, at least until your fellow player decides you've gone too far. But he wasn't quite the boxer he thought he was, so McDaniel tried music again. On March 2, 1955, he found himself in the studios of Chess Records, Chicago's top blues label, recording a song that fused Mississippi and Chicago, his childhood and his adulthood, into a 2.5-minute romp of bragging and good humor. He used the name he'd boxed under and the beat of the broomstick and called it Bo Diddley.
Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring. If that diamond ring don't shine, he gon' take it to a private eye. If that private eye can't see, he better not take the ring from me.
Soon, Bo Diddley and his two-man band, Jerome Green on maracas and insults, and Frank Kirkland on drums, were big stars, enjoying a string of hits through 1962, most of them featuring that Bo Diddley beat. With his square and fur-covered guitars, his outrageous stage act, and his thick glasses, nobody ever took Bo seriously, but I think it's time to reassess Bo Diddley as a folk poet. Certainly the imagery of Who Do You Love is surreal enough, and then there are the nursery rhyme songs like Bo Diddley and Puttin' and Tane. Bo Diddley buying his baby a billy goat just to make her a Sunday coat is part of the same jump rope song that gave us Charlie and Inez Fox's Mockingbird, after all. And Bo's songs of the dozens, Say Man Back Again, and Bo's Vacation, are as close as most of us will get to that street sport, as Bo tells Jerome that Jerome's girlfriend has everything a man would want, a mustache, a hairy chest. But my favorite Bo Diddley songs are the made-up stories. Background to Music is the story of a B-flat looking for work as a background. And then there are the two flies who keep the garbage man away by talking tough. There's Greasy Spoon, where the menu includes such items of new American cuisine as barbecued alligator navels or the surrealist cowboy, You All Green. There's much more to Bo Diddley than that irresistible rhythm in the tales of sexual braggadocio, something that gives us a glimpse at a past we may not fully understand, as in the tale I'll leave you with of the great-grandfather.
The great-grandpappy when the land was young, barred his door with a wagon's on. When the times got tough and the Redskins mob said his prayers with a shotgun cock. Oh, 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 oh. The great grandpappy was a busy man, cooked his grub in a frying pan. Picked his teeth with a hunting knife. He wore the same suit all his life. Children came to be blessed, the old man's house in the wilderness.
That's Bo Diddley's The Great Grandfather. Music critic Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle and is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
What's that, boy?
I want to tell you about your girlfriend.
What about my girl?
But you don't look strong enough to take the message.
I'm strong enough.
I might hurt your feelings. My feelings already hurt.
You're listening to Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is filmmaker Stephen Frears. His film Prick Up Your Ears is getting a lot of attention. It's about the life and violent death of English playwright Joe Orton. The film is adapted from John Lahr's 1978 biography of Joe Orton and Orton's own diaries. 20 years ago, Orton was bludgeoned to death by his lover Kenneth Halliwell. Halliwell then killed himself. When Orton died at the age of 34, his two full-length plays had become hits on the London stage. His plays were comedies that satirized the English middle class. Theatergoers were probably unaware of Orton's own unconventional sexuality. At the time, homosexuality was outlawed in England. Stephen Frears is no stranger to films about outsiders. His popular film, My Beautiful Laundrette, is about people who are out of the mainstream because they're poor, foreign-born, or gay. I asked Stephen Frears why he thought the story of Joe Orton would make an interesting film.
he wasn't in the heroic mold, so it wasn't he wasn't a sort of James Dean figure at all. He didn't drive fast cars or anything like that. But he did live his own life, and it was an odd life. When the Sex Pistols became famous in England in 1976 or whatever it was, there was a T-shirt that was made in the shop where they came from. And they had a list of people they liked and people they didn't like. And Joe Orton was on the list of people they liked. Well, they can't have seen his plays. And I shouldn't think they knew a great deal about his life. The diaries, I think, hadn't been published then. But he'd somehow worked his way into the mythology of the young, as though he was someone who didn't conform, who lived his own life, and was sort of prepared, I mean, for the violence of his end.
The relationship between Joe Orton and his longtime lover, Kenneth Halliwell, ends in a murder-suicide.
Yes.
Some viewers will see Prick Up Your Ears as a cautionary tale about the price of promiscuity and decadence. Is that an accurate reading of your movie?
Well, it isn't. It is true that they die at the end of it, and Joe's life was very promiscuous. It's not at all the reading that I'm interested in, of course, because I find the relationship much more sympathetic than that and much more complex than that. And in fact, since in the film we parallel a conventional heterosexual marriage with their relationship, of course we would say that we're trying to say things about all couples.
What did you do to really get that inside understanding?
I'd grown up in the world in London where I knew a lot of the people that Joe was involved with, and I'd seen people who were involved in the theatre and in living gay lives, and their lives seemed remarkably similar to mine. And so I really used the experience I had and a sort of rather commonsensical approach to it all.
In some films with gay characters, there's no sex on screen. It's left, quote, tastefully off screen. In your film, well, in Prick Up Your Ears, there's no frontal nudity, but there's passionate and juicy tongue kissing,
yes.
And there's some crotch rubbing. Did you think of yourself as brave putting that in the film?
No, not at all. It seemed to me that I neither wish to make a pornographic film or an explicit film, but equally, if you'd made a coy film, it would have been sort of silly, wouldn't it? So you do it as sensibly and as gracefully as you can, and my position is absolutely the same as anyone in the audience. Of not wanting to be embarrassed or attacked, but wanting to understand the relationship. And at all the scenes in the film that involve sex, there's always something else going on, whether it's excitement, whether they're going to be caught by the police, whether it's something else going on. So you didn't have to dwell on the obvious. You wouldn't want to be sentimental and you wouldn't want to be exploitative. It's not made from an outside point of view. It's trying to understand it from the inside.
When you were auditioning for the movie, did you have to explain to the actors that they'd have to have the two main male actors that they'd be involved in kissing scenes? I'm thinking in America, a lot of actors have been afraid to be associated with gay roles for fear that the public would think that they're gay. Hollywood has just always been afraid of homosexuality.
Yes. Since I was dealing with public material, I mean, the actors involved knew what was, they knew what they were letting themselves in for. And I said, look, I cast both the boys on the same day. And I said, look, you have to play these scenes and they're not going to go away or they're not going to, we have to do them properly. And they said, yes, we quite understand. And I said, and they liked each other. And, they were both very, very sensible about it.
The casting in the movie is quite extraordinary. Americans know Gary Oldman through his performance as Sid Vicious.
Yeah.
A drugged-out punk rocker. And that performance is so different than the self-confident, mocking playwright in Prick Up Your Ears. To me, he was just unrecognizable. What did you see in him that made you realize he would be right for the role of Joe Orton?
Well, he has got a rather chameleon-like quality, and he's actually a rather sort of pale, elusive fellow as a, in real life. He's a very, very good actor. And the things you describe, that sort of mocking sexiness, he'd got all that. He had plenty of that. He was sharp and angry and all of those things. It wasn't very difficult to cast him. The man who plays Halliwell was a greater sort of leap.
Yeah, Alfred Molina, who plays Orton's lover, Kenneth Halliwell, is terrific as the dejected, self-conscious, insecure lover who's jealous of Orton's talent and his acclaim.
Yes.
Now, how did you cast him?
Well, he's a very vulnerable man, Fred, and he looks rather extraordinary. And he is a very, very good actor. I think it was... I mean, largely these things are instinctive. Certain things about him made me believe in the character. I mean, Halliwell was a very grotesque figure. I mean, he lost all his hair. He was very, very embarrassing. He used to make an absolute fool of himself in public places. And Fred is a rather conspicuous figure because he's so tall and large. And I imagine quite vulnerable about his appearance in many respects.
You had to, in the direction, bring out a certain grotesqueness in Molina's face. And I was thinking that here's this man who's probably quite striking and really pretty attractive, but because of all the self-hatred that's in the character, the actor starts to look unattractive and kind of grotesque.
Well, if you shave someone's head, they look pretty dreadful. It doesn't help. But he's actually a very attractive man, yes.
Is it ever hard work to make an actor seem unattractive like that, or do they ever resist you?
Well, he knew that was part of the job. I mean, he's a very sympathetic actor, and since we were trying to make the film with sympathy for that character, I suppose it's quite sensible to cast somebody who is actually a very, very lovable man. But he's much too serious an actor, much too disciplined an actor. I mean, he knew that the character was very unattractive, and he went out of his way to play that side of it. He wasn't at all afraid of it.
Prick Up Your Ears is the second film that you've done that has gay characters in it. Do audiences assume that, therefore, you must be gay?
No, I don't think anybody assumes that. I think they're more perplexed. I mean, I've got dozens of children. I mean, it's true not that means anything, but I think I've never been asked the question, really, but I don't think anybody thinks I am.
Do you think a film like this would be riskier for a gay director because then they'd be typecast in a way as doing movies about gays?
I don't. Somebody asked me that the other day, and I don't actually see why. I mean, after all, gay directors make films about straight people, so I don't quite see why a gay director couldn't have made this film. There is a sort of myth that you should cast straight actors to play gay parts, but I don't quite see why it would follow, and I imagine there's plenty of instances that would break that rule.
In Prick Up Your Ears, Joe Orton accepts an award and says that his plays are about characters who are getting away with it, and that he's been getting away with it for years.
Yes, I have a very strong sense of that.
It's the innocents who get it in the neck. But that all seems pretty true to life to me, not a fantasy at all. I've got away with it so far, and I'm going to go on.
Now, you've been making, at least for the movies we've seen in America, you've been making pretty personal, eccentric movies in a time of creeping homogeneity.
Yes.
In film, do you feel like you've been getting away?
Very, very much so. It's very odd. A journalist asked me that the other day. He said, times are supposed to be very bad now. Why is there such goodwill towards this film? I can't explain it. I mean, I see they are very eccentric films, and I've always made rather eccentric films. I've no idea. I do feel very much that I've been getting away with murder. And someone said to me one day, a policeman will knock on my door and say, you can't go on making films like these.
Stephen Frears' new film is Prick Up Your Ears. Just before Joe Orton died, he completed the first draft of a movie commissioned by the Beatles. The screenplay was discovered in 1985, and the rights were bought by theater producer Joe Papp. He plans to bring a musical adaptation to Broadway next year. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hello, Terry.
What's up for tonight?
Well, as part of our ongoing Iran-Contra hearings coverage, tonight we offer a primer on the Boland Amendment. That's the congressional ban on military aid to the Contras. We also visit the naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. 2,500 sailors live there, also 4,000 civilians, and no American has crossed the fence separating the military base from Cuba since Castro took power in 1959. And we profile the father of avant-garde jazz vocalist Bobby McFerrin. Robert McFerrin, Bobby McFerrin's father, sings also, but he specializes in opera.
Okay, thank you, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. South African novelist Nadine Gordimer has been writing about the political and social upheaval in her country for over 40 years. Three of her novels have been banned by the South African government, but both at home and abroad, her novels have been critically acclaimed. Gordimer's latest novel is called Sport of Nature. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
Nadine Gordimer is white, female, English, and liberal in South Africa. She has always told the complicated truth about her native land, which is why so many of her books have been banned there. What's amazing is that the books get better as the situation gets worse. Her new novel, A Sport of Nature, is a commanding performance. Dense, wise, beautiful, crafty, intoxicated by ideas and colors, and very bloody. The revolution, when it comes to South Africa, will do violence to body as well as mind. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, a sport of nature is an abnormal variation or a departure from the parent stock or type, a spontaneous mutation, a new variety. That almost sounds like a revolution, doesn't it? But Gordimer's sport of nature is a woman, Helela, a white South African named for her Zionist grandfather, deserted by her dreamy romantic mother, raised by aunts who were variously rich and silly or conscience-stricken and politically dangerous, an adventuress on three continents who goes to bed with men and wakes up with history. Helela is not an intellectual. She lives entirely in the present tense. She trusts nothing she hasn't personally experienced through her body. The body pressed upon becomes a book, a kind of instruction manual. Reading herself, Helela invents a future in which there is no more room for white South Africans. Helela's body, over four hectic decades in a dozen countries, is pressed upon by many men. There is her cousin Sasha, who goes to prison for organizing black mine workers, and the Canadian journalist and police spy who abandons her in exile, and the French ambassador who shares her with his children, and the black revolutionary who fathers her daughter and dies in her kitchen. There is also the Eastern European Minister of Culture who translates some more Neruda every time he goes to jail, and the American WASP who, from his New York brownstone, manages the merchandising of Helela on the do-good liberal circuit as a sort of third-world white Madonna with a black African child. And finally, there is that face on the postage stamp, the once-and-future Catholic nationalist Marxist African-made president of a new black nation who will choose her for his queen and return her in secret triumph to a South Africa utterly changed, itself a sport of nature. Most of these men, oddly enough, have read Dostoevsky, and each of them teaches Helela whatever he knows about sex, class, color, law, education, economics, art, animals, vegetation, hypocrisy, and terrorism. She eludes the men and their definitions and finds herself and rewrites history to include tough love. The world is full of writers, and many of them are intelligent, but very few seem to know as much as Nadine Gordimer. In A Sport of Nature, from the abrasions of politics on personality, like Marquez, Kundera, Sienka, Solzhenitsyn, Gunter Grass, and Doris Lessing, she makes a savage marvel.
John Leonard reviews television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's what's coming up on our next show. Next time, I'll speak with anthropologist Robert Murphy. His book, The Body Silent, is a candid study of his own condition as a quadriplegic. Classical music reviewer Lloyd Schwartz looks at the career of American composer Elliot Carter, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg describes the Meryl Streepification of Hollywood accents. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY FM in Philadelphia.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Shallett, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. The production assistant is Ed Doherty, and the engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.